today, Native American resistance, yesterday, African American resistance. And today's task is even more impossible because it really needs to look across Latin America, to look at the Mexican Revolution, the Yucatan, and to look at North America, and specifically not even to look at Canada in relationship to indigenous resistance, but the United States. Well, I keep overshooting the mark and trying to present too much. And today, I think because it absolutely was clear even to me that it cannot be done, I'm going to try to do a couple of things. One is I'd like to start with what I think is a more positive note. I'd like to start with the contributions, the cultural gifts we've received from indigenous people. And after that, I can then do a presentation as best as possible about the resistance as well as the repression of Native peoples in the United States. And I probably could get up to the Trail of Tears, maybe Wounded Knee. But I have this, you know, continual dilemma of not wanting to be in a lecture mode, which if it were any other subject, it seems to me, really would be a conversation. But I think that one has to sort of lay out something. We don't all know this. Some of us know pieces of it. I'm just learning it. And so I feel the need to kind of share information, share some history. But in any case, so let me just talk a little bit about today's approach and say that I'd like to do this contributions stop, and at that moment I would like to do one of two things. Present some theological questions that I think emerge on the assumption that some of you have already studied this or at least heard some presentations on what the invasion of the Americas meant. And then just present a few theological speculations and maybe tie it in a little bit with Joan Hunt's presentation on the question of victims and resistance. And then see what you think about that, sort of have you theologize a bit. And then if we can get through that, and I suspect I suspect that'll do it, I could come back and do this presentation, or I could eschew the theological piece and simply present another history after I've done the contributions. That's not really historical. I mean, it's historical gifts, but it's not tracing much. So why don't I just start, and then you'll decide at that moment rather than speculate. In case you have the room wrong, by the way, if you didn't guess, this is the presentation on Native American resistance. My name is Rennie Golden. Well, a book that I would recommend to you if you would like to investigate a little bit of what I'm going to share now is a book by Jack Weatherford. He's written two. Probably the first one would be the most, sort of revelatory, and it's called Indian Givers. The other book that I forgot yesterday to push is a book that we've done, which is called Dangerous Memories. And this Dangerous Memories, Invasion and Resistance since 1492. This book, I think, is an excellent resource for teachers, particularly of high school, college, and church study groups. It also has resources of somebody that's done this kind of curriculum, developed curriculum and teaching strategies for grade schools. The Incans gave us silver. And the gift of silver, which were mined from the mines of Potosi in Bolivia, in Colombia, is a gift that essentially transformed the world economy. Because heretofore, there was never enough abundant source of exchange that wasn't in the hands of kings and lords. That would mean that more of the merchant class, a whole different sector that hadn't been heard from before, would be able to have this form of exchange And really it was the precursor of capitalism, which you could say is the good news or the bad news. But it does mean that there was at least another class introduced into the world beyond simply the monarchy and serfs and peasants. The miners, probably 8 million were consumed in those mines to give this gift to the world. A gift that was controlled and accumulated, obviously not in their hands. Potosi has no silver now. The mines are a museum if you go to visit them. More precious than any metal that was given to us by the Incans was the potato. This brilliant achievement of probably 100 different types of potatoes was transformative for the Europeans because it meant that Southern Europe, which had heretofore dominated Europe because it had a longer growing season and could feed its masses in any kind of struggles or wars for dominance, Southern Europe would no longer have dominance because with the potato, which could be grown in 4 months in a cold climate, masses of Northern Europe could be fed. Ultimately, this really led to the ascendance of Russia. Again, one can say this is a concentration of power that may not be the good news, but it does mean for Europeans there was a whole new way and form of feeding their people, which, along with corn, would be instrumental in overcoming diseases, which, as we talked about, or at least I talked about earlier, some of you might have been here, was rampant. And so this gift to the world. The other crops that were given to us by native peoples are numerous, but I'm trying to single out the potato and its effect. When it comes to appropriate technology, which we are now trying to, in a sense, rediscover, the Mayans and the Aztecs were brilliant. For instance, the city of Tenochtitlan was built on and constructed on a lake. And what that meant is that they had developed a system called the Chinampa system, in which they were able to have irrigation that was continuous, therefore a continuous harvest. They recycled waste. They collected all urine, and it was used for sulfur, and I can't remember what else it was used for. I should quote this. They had a system of organic farming that fed over 100,000 Aztecs, again, adapting this whole area to a lake area. And let's see if I can quote Jan Carew, a Caribbean scholar, on just this particular gift. The Chinampa is anchored by roots of the ahueta tree and by posts and vine walls. Mud from the canals is piled up on a bed of wattles and vines and layers of water weeds which serve as a compost form for the upper section of the plot. This is covered with a layer of fresh mud which provides a fertile medium for planting. The Chinampa plots are usually surrounded by an intricate network of canals. These canals are stocked with carp and other fish and a giant salamander, which is considered a delicacy. The canals also provide organic fertilizer and mulch in the form of abundant green algae, which is skimmed off the water and applied to the plots. Human wastes were collected, treated, and recycled as fertilizer without polluting its indispensable canals. Urine collected separately, broken down, and two of its byproducts were paint and sulfate of ammonia. This was part of the recycling that had become, in this culture, as natural as breathing. The Aztecs also used obsidian scalpels to do brain surgery almost 500 years ago. Other forms of medicine that came to us from the native people were, I mean, and this is at a time where medicine in Europe was really based a lot on witchcraft, which is not to put down witches. The indigenous discovered the cure for malaria, amoebic dysentery, scurvy, lockjaw, and for instance, in Virginia, 1 in 5 of the colonists died of malaria until they were able to use the quinine or the quinaquina, which is a Quechua word, which overcame malaria. Moreover, as far as scurvy was concerned, I can't think of the name of this sea captain that said that his sailors were dying like flies until the Huron Indians offered bark from the Oneida tree, I believe it is, which was able to overcome and transform, to heal, essentially, the condition of scurvy of the sailors. Probably, for me, one of the most remarkable gifts of the many. Now, I could go on talking about everything from witch hazel to blue kokosh and numerous herbs, some that were precursors of modern healing that came from the native peoples. But in the political arena, one of the more remarkable gifts came from the Iroquois Confederation that it seems to me only now is being lifted up and few people even know about. Ben Franklin was the Indian commissioner to Pennsylvania, and he had become very interested in Indian custom and culture. And Franklin besieged the Albany Congress of, 1754, that it should adopt a form of government, a form of political decision-making that came from the Iroquois Confederation. What he was beseeching them to adopt was democracy. We're told that democracy came from our reliance on the Greeks, the Greek city-states, as well as British Parliament. But as a matter of fact, the Greek notion of democracy was pretty elite and very hierarchical, and anybody that's read Plato knows that. Whereas this form of democracy was, I think, the ideal that we strive after and that we at least legalized constitutionally. Which is to say, the Iroquois Confederation, which was five tribes, and I probably won't remember them all, the Seneca, the Onondaga, the Oneida, the Iroquois, and the Cayuga. Because of disunity amongst the tribes, they had unified themselves, and what they developed was a form of governance in which each tribe sent to the council a member that represented their council. The word caucus came from the Iroquois. And that there they would decide on questions that affected all of these tribes. Their symbol for this unity was the great tree of peace. And in fact, their constitution was an oral tradition. It took 24 hours to recite. But this was this is the other very interesting part of this gift of the Iroquois Nation, the Iroquois Confederation, pardon me, is that it was a culture that was based in mother right, which is to say, you'll know that we took major parts of the Indians' gift of democracy, but you'll know right away the parts we skipped. When I say it was based on mother right, the women of the tribe in the longhouses were able to determine if any representative of the tribe was not faithfully representing the perspective of the people. That person could be recalled or impeached. And the people who could recall them were sachems. They were always women. So really, authority rested to a great extent not simply with the men who, you know, as usual, were the tribal representatives, but in terms of some power to impeach, imagine if in our democracy women could impeach throughout the historical years where we'd be now. In any case, that wasn't appropriated. But this was a model that for the colonies, they really didn't have a clue how they would unite themselves in some kind of federal, central government, but at the same time respect the autonomy of the states. Well, here was the Iroquois Confederation. Some of it was taken, a good deal of it was taken, but this gift is not only overlooked, it's been virtually invisible. Well, just looking very briefly at those contributions, that's kind of an easy beginning. What I spoke about earlier in terms of what are some of the theological implications of what we all know was a treatment of the native peoples, which was unjust to say the least. But I don't think we know what that record is. I mean, to really look at that, which I'll try to do, as I say, later. But I want to just start with some of these theological questions, at least that emerged for me the other night. The sort of paradigm that Joan was presenting that feminist theologians have given us is a critique on the doctrine of atonement, which, according to many feminist theologians, in many ways, in a sense, glorifies or at least sacralizes both victimhood and violence. Well, I guess I'm going to give a couple of examples of that in terms of history in relationship to indigenous peoples. First of all, when Bartolomé de las Casas, the bishop who wrote back to Rome saying what terrible atrocities were being perpetrated against the indigenous people, and begged Spain to cease and desist from this policy, ultimately, for his trouble, he was called to Rome for heresy. And there he was to defend himself in a great theological debate. It was the debate of fellow deed. And the great theologian that Rome put up against de las Casas was Sepúlveda. And essentially, if you listen to those arguments, were the arguments of the church for why the forms of conquest that were in place would continue, including the different systems from the encomienda system to the mita system, all of which were gold tribute systems or systems which gave slaves and land to the colonist, gave Indian slaves and lands to the colonist. Why these systems, which were essentially organized violence against the Indians, state-organized violence, would be blessed by the church, which is to say violence would be sacralized. Here were some of Sepúlveda's arguments. He said, one, given the barbarity of the Indians, it is necessary to dominate them by force in order to liberate them. Which reminds you, remember the captain in Vietnam which said, we've raised this village in order to save it? that it was a punishment for idolatry on the part of the Indians. And this is where the just war theory originates. That because of their cannibalism, which really was disputed later by anthropologists, but it's all part of that sort of ideology which has to demonize. And finally, that it was necessary to make wars on unbelievers to prepare them to accept Christianity. So this sacralizing, you know, through a religious rationale for this violence begins here. But, you know, lest we only bash the papacy, this is the Puritans who saw their mission in relationship to the Indians, not even as the Spanish attempted to do to convert them. They felt that the Indians were really to be brought under the control of civil authority. They weren't even to be converted because they were savages. And their mission really was to become a city on the hill, a beacon that would shine to London and to shine to England and to show what a pious people could become. I mean, so this was the experiment in the New World. So this was the elect and the chosen people, and it was their manifest destiny as ordained by divine providence to be this people over and against the unholy ones. And so this was the task of the Puritans, and even as early as 1622, in Jamestown, a struggle is going on between the Indians and the colonists, which is duplicated with the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And when there is disease that is now just killing off major portions of the Pequot, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, anybody who knows, stop me. Indians who are along the Mystic River. John Winthrop says that this is simply God's instrument to clear the land so that the colonists could be there. And the British, Lord Geoffrey Amherst, says, and I quote him, "Could it not be contrived to send this smallpox among the disaffected tribes of Indians?" The disaffected are the ones who resist. The Narragansetts were their friends, so they weren't to get smallpox. "We must on this occasion use every stratagem to reduce them." This is a statement by this is a statement about the Powhatan Indians, and this would be probably 1622. "Because the way of conquering them is much more easier than of civilizing them by fair means, for they are a rude, barbarous, and naked people. Besides that, a conquest may be of many and at once, but civility is in particular and slow the effect of long time and great industry. Moreover, victory of them may be gained by many ways, by force, by surprise, by famine and burning their corn, by destroying and burning their boats, canoes, and houses, by breaking their fishing wares, by assailing them in their huntings, whereby they get their greatest sustenance in winter, by pursuing and chasing them with our horses and bloodhounds to draw after them, and mastiff dogs, to tear them, which take this naked, tanned, deformed savages for no other than wild beasts, and are so fierce that when they fell upon them, they will put in them the fear greater than that of the old devil. By these and sundry other ways, as by driving them when they flee upon their enemies, we may bring ruin or subjection." This subjection will soon be effected. "Because the Indians who before were used as friends may now most justly be compelled to servitude and drudgery and supply the room of men that labor, whereby even the meanest of the plantation may implore themselves more entirely in arts and occupation, whereas they, the savages, should dig the mines and such like inferior work." Now, this was a reaction to the fact that the second chief of the Powhatans, seeing the disease that was rampant, made war upon the colonists and killed 327. As a result, but the policy, you think, well, the Europeans brought smallpox with them and it wasn't their fault, they caught it. And yet you actually read, these are forms of military policy where smallpox was very consciously used. And that's why I quoted both Lord Amherst and quoted Winthrop. And the Indians knew it. I mean, knew that this wasn't simply an infection, that there was an attempt to kill them off. And so they fought back or resisted, and now you hear this sort of ideology, which again, I'm suggesting, doesn't even talk about conversion, but talks about wars against them. I'm going to try to just skip around and go to Tecumseh, and now we're moving all the way up past Pontiac and his great speech in which he calls 18 tribes together to try to fight back and to resist what looks like and what they are now speculating on is an attempt to simply wipe out the native population. Tecumseh makes a plea, and I'd like to read that to you. This is all the way into 1812. I'm really skipping good parts of the 1700s. Tecumseh is trying to rally his braves to act against what this encroachment that, as they see it, is an end to their way of life. He says, "Every year our white intruders become more greedy, exacting, oppressive, and overbearing. Every year contentions spring up between them and our people, and when blood is shed, we have to make atonement, whether right or wrong, at the cost of the lives of our greatest people and the yielding of large tracts of our land. Before the pale faces came among us, we enjoyed the happiness of unbounded freedom and were acquainted with neither riches, wants, nor oppression. How is it now? And then he goes on, will not the bones of our dead be plowed up and our graves be turned into fields? War or extermination are our only choice. Which do you choose, brave Choctaws and Chickasaws? To assist in the just cause of liberating our race from the grasp of our faithless invaders? Presenting them with the question of, will you remain victims or will you resist? Tecumseh, who was called the Shooting Star, was considered in his wars against the Long Knives a brave and a warrior of great compassion. Well, if not compassion, I should say of great principles in wartime. He did not believe in ever torturing prisoners and treated prisoners of war with great respect. Unlike General Proctor, whom when he heard at one of the forts he was giving liquor to the Indians, and because he didn't want the colonists to be responsible for killing prisoners of war. Simply gave out this liquor, and Tecumseh, hearing this, came in, drew his sword, and shouted into the fort, "Are there no men here?" And he stopped the murders, and then went to General Proctor and said, "You know, you're not fit to command." And I think his last statement was to say, "We war to save lives. For you, it is a matter of murder." And I mention this because it's a distinction between the violence of those who are responding to massive violence and the violence of those who are conquering. And there's a distinct and qualitative difference, which is not to deal with the question of violence or nonviolence, but it is to say, well, what is this difference? I mean, what is one a struggle for survival and one for dominance? And what's the difference? I'm going to kind of just again leap now into the 1800s and talk about the Georgia laws of conquest, because the forms and instruments of control were not simply military might, using mastiff dogs, using swords, using muskets against native peoples who didn't have that kind of technology, but also it was the use of law. And one can see that in the laws of conquest in 1829. And Georgia declares, and I have to find this, that the Cherokees can, the laws will stipulate for Cherokees, that their lands will be confiscated, that their Cherokee government must be abolished, that they may not gather in groups of more than three, not even for religious ceremonies, that all contracts between whites and Cherokees are invalid unless there are two white witnesses, that the Cherokees may never testify in a court of law against a white person, that no Cherokee can dig for gold in the Cherokee gold fields. Now, with the discovery of gold, in Georgia, there's an attempt to make new treaties with the Cherokees. Up until now, the colonists have respected the sovereignty of the Cherokees. In fact, they've made many, many treaties with them. And you probably even remember the language. Every treaty was a final treaty. And it usually ended with the statement that this treaty of the sovereignty and respect for the Cherokees' lands will continue as long as the grass shall grow, and as long as the rivers shall run. By 1830, the chief of the Cherokees and their council had to make it a capital offense for any Cherokee to make any kind of a treaty, because their lands were simply being taken away. Knowing that this law making it a capital offense to give away any more of the Cherokee land, particularly anything east of the Mississippi. Nevertheless, some Cherokees, not being accountable to the tribe, made a treaty, I think it was called the Treaty of Etchell. And in that treaty, they gave away the land east of the Mississippi. In the meantime, Andrew Jackson, the Indian fighter, and if you know his reputation, you know with what brutality he fought the Indians. In his bid to be president, made his platform that he would drive the Indians west of the Mississippi, and in specific ways we're talking about the Cherokees. So that when this treaty was made, Chief John Ross got 15,000 signatures of Indians to say that this was not with the permission of the Cherokee people, that it was a small group of Indians that was violating their own laws, and that was presented to Congress. Nevertheless, Congress ratified the treaty, disregarded this plea from the Cherokees, and gave the Cherokees 2 years to leave this nation that had lived in these areas. I guess the one thing I want to say is you cannot imagine how much the Cherokees attempted peace, which is to say they sent delegations to Congress. They had petitions signed. They had protests. They had a bilingual newspaper. They wrote a constitution of their own. They continually tried to respect the treaties that were made. In all of this, they are now given 2 years for all of these people to get up and leave from their lands. Now, you might say, well, what was the Indian removal policy like? How was that done? And we have an eyewitness account of that, and I'd like to read this from a private who was there for the Trail of Tears. And I think this is important to hear, because they could avoid it. This is Private John G. Burnett writing back to his family on his 18th birthday. The removal of the Cherokee Indians from their lifelong homes in the year of 1838 found me a young man in the prime of life and a private soldier in the American Army. I was sent as an interpreter in May of 1838 and witnessed the execution of the most brutal order in the history of American warfare. I saw the helpless Cherokees arrested and dragged from their homes and driven at bayonet point into the stockades. And in the chill of a drizzling rain on an October morning, I saw them loaded like sheep or cattle into 645 wagons and started to the west. One can never forget the sadness and solemnity of that morning. Many of these helpless people did not have blankets, and many of them had been driven from home barefooted. On the morning of November 17th, we encountered a terrific sleet and snowstorm with freezing temperatures. From that day until we reached the end of the fateful journey on March 26th, the suffering of the Cherokees was awful. The trail of exiles was a trail of death. They had to sleep in the wagons and on the ground without fire. And I have known as many as 22 of them to die in one night of pneumonia due to ill treatment, cold, and exposure. Among the number was the beautiful Christian wife of Chief John Ross. This noble-hearted woman died a martyr to childhood, giving her only blanket for the protection of a sick child. She rode thinly clad through a blinding sleet and snowstorm, developed pneumonia, and died in the still hours of a bleak winter morning. The painful journey to the west ended March 26, with 4,000 silent graves reaching from the foothills of the Smoky Mountains to what is known as the Indian Territory in the west. Covetousness on the part of the white race was the cause of all that the Cherokees had to suffer. At this time, this is 1890 when he's writing, we are too near the removal of the Cherokees for our young people to fully understand the enormity of that crime that was committed against a helpless race. At this time, in the 90s, we are too far removed. He goes on and says, murder is murder. Somebody must answer. Somebody must explain the streams of blood that flowed in the Indian country in the summer of 1838. Somebody must explain the 4,000 silent graves that marked the trail of the Cherokees to their exile. I wish I could forget it all. But the picture of 644 wagons lumbering over the frozen ground with their cargo of suffering humanity still lingers in memory. From 1825 on, as I suggested, the Cherokees petitioned for peace. In 1838, just before the Trail of Tears, President Martin Van Buren's response was, "No state can achieve proper culture, civilization, and progress in safety as long as Indians are permitted to remain." In 1864, Black Kettle, a Cheyenne, attempts peace. He sticks in the ground of the Cheyenne villages and flies an American flag given him by Colonel Greenwood. He does this to forsake violence and to say that the Indians seek peace. A young colonel is at Fort Lyon, Lyon. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's Lyon or Lyon in Colorado. Perhaps I'm giving it a French twist. The colonel's name is Wynkoop. I mention these soldiers and those who document from the side of whites a humanity, but their voice was swallowed by this system of state violence that is both by state and church, as I've suggested, made sacred. Wyckoff, two of the Cheyennes come to him as representatives of Black Kettle, and they come into the fort, and he's very, very suspicious. He has his soldiers watching the horizon to see if there are others. He brings them in, and he's very, very careful of them. And they ask him if he will come with them to visit Black Kettle, to talk about the possibilities of peace between these two peoples. And so the young colonel goes with him, and he says on his trip after he's been with these Cheyennes for days as they travel out to Black Kettle, he says, "I felt myself in the presence of superior beings, and these were the representatives of a race that I had heretofore looked upon without exception as being cruel, treacherous, and bloodthirsty." Again, the ideology that just infects the colonist, and then the conversion when he actually meets the people. And so Wyckoff goes to the governor of Colorado and to Colonel Chivington, who is the colonel in charge of fighting the Indians in this area. And Governor Evans' response to this young colonel is, "I want no peace till the Indians suffer more. What shall I do with 3rd Colorado Regiment if I make peace? They have been raised to kill Indians. Kill Indians they will." Wyckoff, we know the story, right? Wyckoff is transferred. Major Scott Anthony takes his place. In 1864, at Sand Creek, Colonel Chivington enters upon Black Kettle and his people. They are flying the American flag. It is a place, Sand Creek is filled essentially with squaws and children. There are probably, I think they'll tell the number here when I read the account of an interpreter named Robert Brent who was at the scene at Sand Creek. And this is the Sand Creek massacre. The command consisted of from 900 to 1,000 men. We left Fort Lyon, and came to the Indian camp at daylight the next morning. Colonel Chivington surrounded the village with his troops. When we came in sight of the camp, I saw the American flag waving and heard Black Kettle tell the Indians to stand around the flag, and there they were huddled, men, women, and children. I also saw a white flag raised, a white flag. These flags were in so conspicuous a position that they must have been seen. When the troop fired, the Indians ran. I think there were 600 Indians in all, 35 braves, and some old men, about 60 in all. They all fought well. I saw 5 squaws under a bank for shelter. When the troops came upon them, the women ran out and showed their person to let the soldiers know that they were squaws and begged for mercy. But the soldiers shot each one. There seemed to be indiscriminate slaughter. There were some 30 or 40 squaws collected in a hole for protection. They sent out a little girl, maybe 6 years old. She had a white flag on a stick. She had not proceeded a few steps when they shot her and killed her. All the squaws in that hole were afterwards killed. Everyone I saw dead was scalped. I saw one squaw cut open with an unborn child lying by her side. I saw the body of White Antelope with his privates cut off, and I heard a soldier say he was going to make a tobacco pouch out of them. I saw a little girl, 5 years old, who had been hid in the sand. 2 soldiers discovered her, drew their pistols and shot her, and then pulled her out of the sand by her arm. I saw quite a number of infants in arms killed with their mothers. After Sand Creek, Red Cloud, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Dull Knife, Roman Nose, unite. They will strike back, and not even General Sherman of other infamy will be able to defeat them. Again at Wounded Knee, we will see another massacre. But the fact is, the resistance of the Indians, and we know what happened at Little Bighorn, an incredible victory for the Native peoples against just overwhelming power. By 1872 at Wounded Knee, there is gold discovered in the sacred Pahasapa, which is where the sacred hoop of the world unites all four directions of the world. What will happen at Wounded Knee, you know that story, when 300 will be killed. And you know the story up until 1972, when again at Wounded Knee, the people will attempt to fight the same forms of colonization. And it's after Wounded Knee that there is a movie that I want to recommend to you that you see now. And I can't tell you what an important documentary I think that it is in terms of this sort of recovering of this lost history. It's a documentary that was made by Robert Redford, and it is really the story of what happened to Leonard Peltier. It's called Incident at Ogallala, and it's the story of the Lakota, it's the story of the Sioux, and it's what happens following Wounded Knee in 1972, and what leads up to this incident in which two FBI agents are killed and Leonard Peltier is still in prison. And this puts forward the case of, did Leonard Peltier do it? And it seems to me that it's a very important documentary to be seen. One of the people who was at Wounded Knee was a Mi'kmaq Indian, a mother of, I believe, six. Her name was Anamayaquash. Anamayaquash, because of her involvement with AIM, the American Indian Movement at Wounded Knee, was found on Pine Ridge in a snowbank, mysteriously killed. She wouldn't be the first Native American activist who resisted, who was killed or imprisoned. But incredibly, I told the story of these black hands of resistance that were cut off yesterday, and the implications of these hands that were stuck on poles in Louisiana that was supposed to terrify the black community. But for some blacks, they were dangerous memory. They were a reminder of the courage of the people of resistance. Anamayaquash's hands were like that. Her hands could be seen as the hands of a victim, or they could be seen as symbol of resistance. The FBI cut off her hands and sent them in a mason jar to Washington to have her fingerprinted to see if she was one of the rebels and the resistors. And yet, the Sioux and the Lakota remember those hands as hands of courage. This is Anamayaquash's statement when she was brought up before a court. This would have been in, I believe, the mid-70s, 1970s. I am speaking now before the court in terms of charges against her. I am part of this creation as you are, no more and no less than each and every one of you within the sound of my voice. I am the generation of generations before me. If I have gone against the creation, no man in this universe holds the power to punish me other than the Creator. You are continuing to control my life with your violent, materialistic needs. I realize you need to survive. You must realize we need to survive. Well, the sort of theological questions that I think get posed as a result of all of this, if I can find my various papers here. Again, as I suggested, are related to Joan's questions about this notion of violence that is both sacralized and organized by the state, sacralized by the church, and the question of victimhood and resistance. I think that there are maybe three questions that are presented to us, at least, in terms of here and now. One of them is, and I'm not simply speaking of Native peoples now, but one of them is, who are the violating? The other is, what is the source of the violence? I don't think there's an easy, I mean, I think this is a tougher question. Different groups have different answers. But it seems to me that the violence is organized, and the violence has a source. If it's diffuse, we can never really attempt to resist, to challenge it. And then, what must be done to stop it? Now, I realize that these are sort of different sets of questions. This one is the one that I think the church doesn't grapple with. I think if the church did, we'd have something that would be called strategic theology. And I'm just saying that because I think the strategy question is to say, well, what do we have to do? But I do think we have to say, well, who are the violated? And that may be an easy answer. But I mean, to start to link the forms of oppression that we see. And then, I don't know that this is easy. What is the source of the violence here and now in this culture at this moment? Because if we don't know that, we really can't say what we're going to stop because we don't know what it is. We don't know where it's concentrated. We don't know how to name it. Well, we have some time remaining, and I don't know if you would prefer to get into groups of six and take your stab at this and then bring it back to a plenary, or if you want to just have a sort of open discussion now where everybody takes a shot at this. How much time do we have left? About
7 minutes till five.
Well, we have to have an open discussion, right? Anybody, take anything you want out of this you'd like.
Well, you look around and there's so much violence, it's just overwhelming. I mean, you just pick any page of a newspaper or any city in our own country, there's just one form of violence after another. It's overwhelming to me. I don't know where to begin. It just seems like it's leading to some kind of inevitable, I don't know, Holocaust in itself. It's just almost like there's too many of us. It's almost like we're so crowded together in so many places that we just are turning on each other all across the world. I think those were, I'm not trying to use that as an excuse or anything like that. I don't know how to deal with it.
Well, maybe what we can do with some characteristics. The violated are powerless. And they are powerless in their own eyesight. And they are powerless in the sight of those who have power. It seems like the ones who have power are the ones who do the violating. But I don't know if that's really getting to the source.
Well, it's a good start.
I also think
because you're already defining this in relationships of power, and sometimes we don't.
I also think sometimes I sense that when a person doesn't have power, they become violent.
Yes.
That might be a different thing. Yeah, they would be the violators.
Trying to get
yeah.
power.
No, I don't think people respond, but people responding to violence.
Yeah.
They're not the violators. They are the violated, but they're.
Yeah, I was thinking it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, but taken in terms of a concrete situation, a man who batters his wife often will express powerlessness himself. Okay? And because of his own sense of powerlessness, often will take it out on her. Okay? The two of them work together, that's another whole complex.
But then he's not the violated. See, I was twisting that around.
Well, yeah, but in a sense, he is the violated because he's trying to grasp the power that is not his own personal power, but grows out of his own sense of powerlessness. And I think that might be true even on the highest levels of our government, where we do have individuals who, within themselves, don't have a sense. Well, let me see. I think it was LBJ that said once that the president has great powers of destruction, but almost none that are creative or upbuilding. That's very true.
So one of the things you're at least pointing out is that these power relationships are destructive both to the powerful and the powerless. So that I would think if the powerless take that ability to continue the violence away from the powerful, it's an act of liberation for both. But in any case, again, we're back to the question that some people have power and some people don't. That power corrupts the powerful.
Doesn't taking power away from the powerful just reverse the problem?
I think that's a good question, and I want to hear from more people, because we're really trying to get, because that gets to the strategic stuff. Yeah. It's jumping ahead, but let's still.
I was thinking of another example with the Los Angeles riots. People who were without power finally saying we had it, but what did they do? They took power and destroyed people, property, anything they could lay their hands on, and they didn't get the guys to do it. Yeah. So maybe in that sense, though, there's another level that your second question would be, say, yeah, they took power, but that's still not really the source of what they were after. The source was more rooted in joblessness and homelessness and some of those even below the power issues.
Well, but I mean, joblessness, homelessness is all a result of being powerless, you're saying.
Yeah.
Or powerlessness as a result of not having jobs, not having, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah.
So there's some kind of economic
violence. Then when you finally get up to here with it, that the only thing you have left to do is to break out in violence. So rather than say that we need to treat the violence, you know how to stop it, we need to look at the causes underneath the violence.
That'd be getting to this question, wouldn't it be? What is the source of the violence? I might add, if you talk to people of color about L.A., they don't talk about it the way we do. They just don't talk about it the way we do, any more than this history is the history that we were taught. They talk about it differently, and they see it differently. I mean, you know, we don't have to exactly get into that now, but I've certainly been in a conversation with African Americans as well as Central Americans who had most of their stuff burned down in LA and in fact lost more property even than the African Americans did. But they see it very differently than the way we just described it, just to say that. But so this question is, well, what, I mean, in a sense, if we say who are the violated, we could go through a list, you know, of peoples of color, of women, of disabled people, of gay people in this culture. We could go through a list. That we could figure out. But I think this is harder. Well, what I mean, because the violence is organized. You know, in a way, if it's just sort of all over there, we're paralyzed and we can't act. And if we don't act in some ways, we really become observers. Or, as Thomas Merton would say, guilty bystanders. And the worst would be complicit. In other words, because it's going on, and we know it's going on every single day, and then the question is what must be done, but we can't answer that until we know this. Any other?
You want to answer the second one, what is the source?
Yeah, don't you think that's important?
Yeah, I think the source is greed and fear.
Okay, I'm just
going to
put that down.
And by that, I think the people that have the power, the privileged and powerful people, are afraid they're going to lose it, are afraid of being attacked or losing their power or their positions of privilege. And so they and society in a great number of ways tries to keep the people who don't, that is the oppressed people, the powerless people, where they are.
Okay.
And it gets very complex. You know, I go for a run every day right through the Native American community, and there are virtually no adult male Native Americans that I see who are sober. And, you know, how that all comes about, it's real clear to me, comes from this wanting to control and not lose the material possessions and the security that we think we have.
Could we generalize the greed and fear to a basic assumption that the world exists and there's not enough? The perception of the world.
Of scarcity, you mean?
Is that the thing that moves or motivates or is the central characteristic of this created world in which we live is scarcity. There's never enough.
I mean, that's a perception at the
perceptual level. Yeah. And that this evokes the greed and fear.
A perception of scarcity. Yeah. Where does that come from, though?
You know, like when Columbus came over, that doesn't seem like that was, I'm just throwing this bit, you know, when he came over here, it didn't, you know, was that out of a feeling of scarcity or just greed for more? I mean, I don't know.
Well, scarcity in Europe, abundance here.
What?
Scarcity in Europe, but abundance here. Away here, to me, this.
But as a matter of fact, because there was abundance here, why was the mentality that there was scarcity? I mean, what drove that?
You don't need more if you've got enough. But if you always understand yourself never to have enough, and it's not even at the level that is spoken, this is really down at the bottom.
Where does it come from? Where does that sense that you've got to have more or you've got to accumulate, where does that come from? Where does the need to accumulate? Because if you don't accumulate, you won't have enough. As opposed to saying, you know, there'll always be enough because we'll share. Where is that?
I wonder if the sense of accumulation is a later development, but at a basic root level, it might be that we must be perfect. And that's why we don't have everything that we need.
I think there's another level in there too, though. When I was thinking about what you were reading with Cherokee and all the rest of it, our history of broken treaties, there was always a judgment about they don't deserve it, we do.
Mm-hmm. We're the elect.
Yeah.
It's our destiny.
And therefore, it's not even so much greed as I need more, but this belongs to me rightfully. And therefore, we can move them up.
I think it might be also is the fear of the violence that is going to eventually occur against all peoples. That if you have enough to defend yourself against that violence and you're accumulating that now, that then you'll be able to hold out longer against the violence that's coming.
This is almost the Cold War policy, isn't it, since
that's
World
right.
War II? Almost exact. National security has driven policy in this country since World War II, and I bet you a few of you know that there was an actual document that came out in 1947. George Kennan was the ambassador to Russia, and basically it said, I'm going to just summarize it. It was a classified document. It's only come out in the last 10 years, and basically it said, we have 60% of the world's resources. Whereas we only have 6% of the world's population. We must devise an economic and political and military policy that will maintain that ratio. It's that direct. It's that broad. This was a national security document, and the National Security Council is going to be developed right then after World War II. I mean, we didn't have that before. So that national security, our security, has been the rationale for practically every president that has gone to war or had a, quote, police action. So, yes, certainly that is a rationale. But even before this, going back, we're still trying to get at this question. You're saying it's greed and fear. People seem to agree. You wanted to get in.
Well, I was just thinking in the history of the faith, the accumulation or wealth was a sign of virtue.
Mm-hmm.
So it was encouraged in the life of faith as one who was faithful and just accumulated and had the goods.
Mm-hmm.
And the outcast did not.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a sign of faithfulness.
Mm-hmm.
So there was another whole thing undergirding that.
Where are you getting that from? You don't read the prophets and you read Proverbs. It's there.
Okay.
You can watch the guys on TV, too. I mean, that's their
message. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But one thing to bring up is that what we know is out of our faith, we can really come up with a theology of the disenfranchised, of the oppressed, or we can come up with a theology of empire. And you know, and I think in all of this, what about you and I? Because we, in a sense, we're not the powerful and we're not the powerless. We have some privilege at the same time. We don't control the decisions. We are caught. And really, we end up with a choice. Whose side are we on? Where do we place ourselves? And I think place ourselves means what's our faith practice and with whom do we practice? But I'm jumping ahead because that's getting to this question. And I think that's an incredible question, what must be done to stop it. But I still think we have to get at this. I'm going to just read this one quick thing. This is from Father Eacuria, who was one of the Jesuits who was killed when the six Jesuits and their two housekeepers were slain. And this is what he says, at least about the church in relationship to the question of whose side are you on. And he also takes a shot at the questions that we're asking, not directly, so I'm just going to share this. Eacuria says, the root of our problem in the South, Latin America, he's reflecting on the quincentenary, is that the dominant civilization of today, and this is true of both East and West, you know, or codified the North, is the civilization of capital. Against that civilization, we must struggle to construct a new civilization, the civilization of work. The destiny of humanity cannot be ruled by the laws of capital or the market, but it must be ruled by work, the creativity of people, not to accumulate in order to produce capital, but to produce humanity. Now, if I put this, I mean, this is Eacuria's using this language, and it's pretty much looking in terms of the rich and the poor nations, or the rich and the poor. If I were to talk in terms of patriarchy, you could talk about who has power in that kind of a paradigm. If I were to talk in terms of race, you could understand who the powerful are and who the powerless are. He goes on and he says, but what is happening now is that the current conqueror in the Western world, now he's not having trouble figuring this out from his perspective in El Salvador.